positions taking places in some of them maybe traffic as possible. So 199 issue rates, which is nearly important, but I understand that in SNUS is more difficult to traffic. Can the people standing there at the back, can you also launching a demonstration? If you're not launching a demonstration, you kind of sit up and go with a very nervous and uncomfortable. Mr. J.B. Siwanoni is a practicing attorney and he's got a court-heard matter that he wants to finalize this week. He thought it would happen during the recess. Sheila Strada is in another practicing attorney.
Jefferson, thank you very much. For the purpose of this briefing, Chair, we distributed a hard copy of this on presentation in English, which is Mr. Sakkar. Also a document, which is a concise briefing document, looking like this. And then Mr. Ramana assured me that members have also been furnished with copies of the Convention against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, Degrading Treatment or Punishment. I think it will be often referred to as UNCAT, and which of course forms the basis of this legislation, Chair. Chair, then I'm accompanied by my colleague, Advocate Otto von der Volk, and she will assist the committee in dealing with this briefing. And of course, then we are available for whatever questions or other assistance we may give to the committee chair. With your leave, I will hand over to Ms. Van Hoff.
Okay, any questions? thank you for the opportunity. We really like to inform you a little bit about this bill that we've prepared. On the slide, it says prevention and combating of torture bill, but in the meantime, we've added the extra word. It's now the prevention and combating of torture of persons bill, and now this slide went away. We will be looking voluntarily. In the meantime, maybe I should just do something just to give a little bit of background to this role. South Africa ratified the convention. I'm just going to use the word convention throughout. Now, South Africa ratified this convention on 10 December 1998. Now, that's a long time ago. Then we prepared a draft bill during 2003. And in preparing the bill, legislation from the United Kingdom, Australia, Ireland, Canada, New Zealand, as well as national legislation and other international instruments were considered. It was submitted to numerous role players for comment during 2004. Comments were received and evaluated. Then, after the comments were evaluated, the further draft was prepared during 2005, but was not included in the Department's legislative programs for the following years due to competing priorities. The department has from time to time interacted with interested parties on further developments, which has resulted in further inputs which were evaluated and included in an updated version of the current bill. Now, the purpose of the bill is to incorporate the convention in our domestic law to first of all ensure that South Africa conforms to the obligations as set out in the convention and to enhance the provisions of Chapter 2 of the Constitution. I can give you a brief summary of the convention if you would like to have that, or I can just proceed with the provisions of the bill. That would be if you like. Alright. Now, the ratification information contained in the convention states that the obligation of states under the Charter of the United Nations, in particular Article 55, is to promote universal respect for and observance of human rights and fundamental freedom. Both Article 5 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and Article 7 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights provide that no one shall be subjected to torture or to cruel, inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment. Now, the convention defines torture as any act by which severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mental, is intentionally inflicted on a person for such purposes as obtaining from him or her or a third person information or a confession, punishing him or her for an act he or a person has committed or is suspected of having committed, or intimidating or coercing him or a third person, or for any reason based on discrimination of any kind, when such pain or suffering is inflicted by or at the instigation of or with the consent of a public official or other person acting in an official capacity. It does not include pain or suffering arising only from inherent in or incidental to wrongful sanctions. Then Article 2 requires for each state party to take effective legislative, administrative, judicial or other measures to prevent acts of torture in any territory under its jurisdiction. Article 3 prohibits the extradition of persons to another state where there is substantial grounds that there might be gross flagrant or mass violations of human rights. Article 4 obliges each state party to ensure that all acts of torture, including an attempt to commit torture, and an act by any person which constitutes complicity or participation in torture are offensive under the criminal law and to make these offences punishable by appropriate penalties, taking into account their great nature. In terms of Article 5 deals with extraterritorial jurisdiction. Article 6 deals with the taking into custody of a person alleged to have committed any offence, the offence of torture then. In terms of Article 7, the state party under whose jurisdiction a person who is alleged to have committed any offence referred in Article 4 is found shall, if he does not extradite such person, submit the case to the competent authority. So it's either extradite or prosecute. Article 8 provides that the offence referred to in Article 4 shall be deemed to be included as extraditable offences in any extradition treaty existing between state parties. Article 9 requires from state parties to afford one another the greatest measure of assistance in connection with criminal proceedings brought in respect of any of the offences referred to in Article 4. Article 10 obliges parties to ensure that education and information regarding the prohibition against torture are fully included in the training of law enforcement personnel, civil, military, medical personnel, public officials, and other persons who may be involved in the custody, interrogation, or treatment of any individual. Each state party must in terms of Article 11, regularly review interrogation rules, instructions, methods and practices, as well as the arrangement for the custody and treatment of persons subjected to any form of arrest, detention or imprisonment in any territory under jurisdiction. Article 12 provides that each state party must ensure that its competent authorities proceed to a prompt and impartial investigation. Article 13 deals that each state party must ensure that any individual who alleges he has been subjected to torture in any territory has the right to complain and has his case examined. Article 14 deals with compensation and provides as follows. Each state party shall ensure in its legal system that the victim of an act of torture obtains redress and has enforceable right to fair and if adequate compensation, including the means for as full rehabilitation as possible. In the event of the death of the victim as a result of an act of torture, this defendant shall be entitled to compensation. Article 15 provides that the statement which was made as a result of torture shall not be invoked as evidence in any proceeding except against the person accused of torture as evidence that the statement was made. In terms of Article 16, every state party must undertake to prevent in any territory under jurisdiction other acts of cruel, inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment which do not amount to torture as defined in Article 1 of the Convention. Article 7 provides for the establishment of the United Nations Committee Against Torture, the committee, the functions of the committee, and the election of members of the committee. Now, from Article 7 onwards, it deals only with the committee and how it's constituted and its functions, which are not really relevant for purposes of the law. So, if you would like me to quickly go through that onwards, otherwise we can proceed to the law. Right. Now, the contents of the bill, first of all, it comprises the preamble, 10 clauses, and the schedule. Now, the preamble reminds us of the shameful issue of gross human rights, human rights abuses, including the torture of many of the citizens, inhabitants of South Africa. That South Africa has since 1994 become an integral and accepted member of the Community of Nations, that South Africa is committed to the preventing and combating of torture of persons by bringing persons who carry out acts of torture in any form to justice, and that South Africa is committed to carrying out its obligation in terms of the Convention. Clause 1 contains various definitions. Clause 2 outlines the object and the interpretation of the law. Now, the object of the law are to give effect to the public's obligations in terms of the Convention, provide for the prosecution of persons who commit offences referred to in the law, provide for measures aimed at the prevention and combating of torture, provide for the training of persons, and when interpreting the law, the court must promote the values of the Article 2 of the Constitution. Clause 3 deals with acts that will constitute torture. And for purposes of the law, torture means any act or omission by which severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mental, is intentionally inflicted by a public official on a person in order, first of all, to obtain information or confession from him or her or a third person, to punish him or her for an act he or she or a third person has committed, or is suspected of having committed, or of planning to commit, or intimidate or coerce him or her or a third person to or to refrain from doing anything or for any reason based on discrimination of any kind. But torture does not include pain or suffering arising from inherently or incidental to lawful actions. Now, I want to just give you a little bit of notes on clause 3. The definition is identical to the definition of torture in the Convention. said, in his health, that it is the most appropriate course of action not to deviate from that definition. The foundation of torture is dealt with in first court and provides that any public official who commits torture, attempts to commit torture, or instigates, commands, or procures any person to commit torture, or any person who participates in torture, conspires with a public official to aid or procure the commission of or to commit torture, will be guilty of an offence and will, on conviction, be liable to a sentence of imprisonment, including imprisonment for life. The fact that an accused person is or was a head of state or government, a member of government or parliament, an elected representative, or a government official, or was under a legal obligation to obey a manifestly unlawful order of a government or superior is neither a defence to a charge of committing an offence referred in this section, nor a grounds for any possible reduction of statements once that person has been convicted of such a thing. A state of war, threat of war, internal political instability, or any other public emergency may not be invoked as a justification for torture. No one shall be punished for disobeying and failing to commit an act of denouncing the torture. Now, a couple of notes on clause 4. The Geneva Conventions of 1949 are aimed at clarifying international principles that govern the conduct of war and the treatment of civilians and non-combatants during a situation of war. The basic principle being that persons who are not actively engaged in hostilities should be treated humanely. The treaties of 1949 were ratified in whole or with reservations by 194 countries, including South Africa. Now, torture and other ill treatment by the agents of state that are party to the Geneva Convention of any person covered by the Four Conventions are expressly prohibited by Article 3 of the Geneva Convention. Article 8 of the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, which defines war crimes, also criminalizes torture and inhuman treatment. Article 7 criminalizes torture as a crime against humanity when it is committed as part of a widespread or systemic attack directed against any civilian population. South Africa has incorporated these definitions and consequently criminalized torture perpetrated in terms of these definitions in the implementation of Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court Act 2002. Regarding the question whether the convention, with its mandate to protect human rights, will also apply, it should be noted that while it was originally thought that international humanitarian law applies during periods of armed conflict to the exclusion of human rights law, the modern trend is that human rights law can also apply during armed conflict. It is argued that the Geneva Conventions will not override the Torture Convention during times of armed conflict, and that the Torture Convention will still be applicable to the extent possible in the circumstances. Clause 5, that clause deals with factors to be considered in sentencing. Aggravating factors for the purpose of sentencing are, first of all, racial discrimination against the complainant, the state of the complainant's mental health, whether the complainant had any physical disability, whether the complainant was under the age of 18 years, whether the complainant was raped or indecently assaulted, the use of any kind of weapon to harm the complainant, the infliction of serious physical harm to the complainant, the conditions in which the complainant was detained, the role of the convicted person in the offence, previous convictions relating to torture, and lastly the physical and psychological effects the torture has on the complainant. Clause 6 deals with the jurisdiction of the South African court. Any person who commits an offence concentrated in the court outside the territory of the Republic is deemed to have committed that offence in the territory of the Republic if, first of all, that person is a South African citizen, that person is not a South African citizen but is ordinarily resident in the Republic, that person is after the commission of the act of torture lawfully present in the territory of the Republic and is not extradited as provided for in Article 8 of the Convention, or lastly, that person has committed the offence against a South African citizen or against a person who is ordinarily resident in the Republic. If a person is alleged to have committed such an offence outside the territory of the Republic, no prosecution may be instituted without the consent of the National Director of Public Prosecution, who must, if he or she decides to prosecute, designate the court in which the prosecution must be conducted. A couple of notes on this clause is Article 5 of the Convention deals with extraterritorial jurisdiction. Paragraph 1 of Article 5 provides that each state party shall take such measures as may be necessary to establish its jurisdiction over offences referred to in Article 4, but that's now the offences of commission. States are bound by the Convention as being part of customary international law. Clause 5 of the Bill therefore does nothing more than give effect to what is required of state parties to the Convention. Clause 7 says that in terms thereof, nothing contained in this Act affects any liability which a person may incur under the common law or any other law. I want to just quickly give a few notes on Clause 7. The state legislation in countries such as the United Kingdom, Australia and Canada reveals that no specific provision is made for redress and the rehabilitation of victims of torture. The only specific mention of compensation could be found in Section 5 of the New Zealand Crimes of Torture Act 1989, where it is provided that the Attorney General can consider the question of compensation. Now, damages and compensation for damages in South Africa are regulated largely by our common law. Section 300 of the Criminal Procedure Act 1977 is the only relevant statutory provision which provides for the payment of compensation to a victim of crime. In our common law, damages for any loss caused by bodily injury and death are usually classified as general damages and special damages. One of the points of criticism raised previously was that the bill does not have any specific provision for redress or create a mechanism for this purpose. The proposed clause 7, sorry, it's not clause 6 as indicated there, is deemed to be sufficient to address the matter and give effect to what the Convention requires. Clause 8 places the duty on the state to promote awareness of the prohibition against torture aimed at the prevention and combating the torture. One or more cabinet ministers designated by the president must cause programs to be developed in order to conduct education and information campaigns regarding the gravity of torture, and to provide assistance and advice to victims of torture, and to train public officials on the prohibition, prevention and combating of torture. Clause 9 provides for the amendment of law specified in the schedule. Clause 10 contains the short title of the bill. Now, the schedule provides for the amendment of Schedule 1 to the Criminal Procedure Act 1977, by including the offences referred to in the bill in the list of offences for which a police officer or a private person may arrest the suspect without a warrant of arrest. It also amends parts 2 and 3 of Schedule 2 to the Criminal Procedure Act 1977 by listing the offences referred to in the bill as offences in respect of which bail may not be granted before a first appearance in court, and an accused may not be released or warning in general files. It also amends Schedule 1 to the Prevention of Organised Crime Act 1998 to include the offences referred to in the bill as offences in respect of which one, preservation orders and poor forfeiture orders may be made. And that is a quick summary of the bill.
Gee, thank you, not at this stage. I mean, this, I forgot, I should have mentioned earlier, we also supported by the stakeholder advisors who were involved in the drafting and certification of this book, Mr. Alan Small and his colleague. I've asked him just to introduce his colleague as well. Yeah.
Yes, thank you, Jay. Angelique Stoffel, she's assisting me as I'm visioning here. Thank you.
Simply to welcome the chair, and I would suggest that we proceed to advertising for submissions. The only thing on which I wish to ask for information or clarification if you like, under clause 6. This will surely strengthen the hand of someone like Anton Ackerman at priority times at the NBA, who has been vindicated by a ruling in the Victoria High Court. To the effect that the Zimbabweans tortured in that country could have been prosecuted in this country, and I wonder if that will now impact the case. But clause 6 would strengthen his hand, would it not? Failing extradition, these people can now be. Yeah. So he will now have two statutes behind him.
Chair, thanks. I mean, like, we've got to advertise for public comment. There's two sub-questions. At the end of the convention, there's some detail of parties that have opened, that signed the convention.
Mm-hmm.
Can we get a list of parties that have signed and parties that have ratified? And in particular, I don't know if you know offhand what is the position of the United States of America. I don't see them on this initial list. What is there is an initial list going up to, I think, 1985. Then, Article 3, the extradition. I don't see that in the bill. Is that dealt with? Of the Article 3 of the Convention, no state party should expel, return, or extradite a person where there is substantial grounds for believing that he would be in danger of being subjected to torture. Presumably, I mean, this following on from Clause 6, presumably it would be, I mean, if one thinks of Spain and the attempts to prosecute the former leader of Chile, Pinochet, we would be able to, if there were a South African or a person ordinarily resident in South Africa who was tortured in, let's say, Chile, we would have been able to prosecute Pinochet if he was or any person directly involved. That would be my reading of it. And then the other aspect is that no, that's fine. Yeah, those are the questions. Thanks.
Thanks, Chair. Just one quick question. Clause 3B of the bill. Where it says torture does not include pain or suffering arising from the board stable to lawful actions. What kind of lawful actions are you envisaging with that statement? No. Hello.
Would that include
death penalty? Yeah, because I mean, if you're torturing someone to obtain information for the purpose, it doesn't seem to make sense to have treaty.
I mean, my understanding was it because I was wondering whether this could this apply to countries that have the death penalty, and but the definition is you know, if you can't punish the person, but there's an exclusion of when the pain or suffering is inflicted at the instigation of, it does not include pain or suffering arising only from inherent to or incidental to lawful sanctions. So presumably you can have, if the death penalty is on your statute books, that is not a problem. It is not defined as torture.
question you asked.
That's a question. Presumably, if you... No. It's a question. Presumably, if your statute books provide for corporal punishment, that is allowed. If your statute book provides for chopping off limbs as a punishment, that is allowed. That would be my understanding, where it says it's inherent to, inherent in or incident to lawful sanctions.
Then you want to add to your previous question about the United States, whether any of the Sharia law governed countries are signatories to themselves.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Hmm. I just have one question, and just simply because the Geneva Convention has been so interested in that, I was just out of curiosity if it's entirely inapposite to the Geneva Convention. But was there not an outstanding protocol? One of the Geneva protocols that we never ratified.
Sure. Yeah, thank you, Chair. I would have actually loved to see in some of the accompanying notes a reference being made to the UN Conference on Racism. Because this was a milestone taking into consideration the culture we used to be. But also at the same time, as we develop this bill, I think one other thing that is important is accountability measures. And I wish to see in this bill accountability measures that actually would help enforce systems that would make the country to report, especially at UN level, so that we are closely monitored as a state.
In this regard. I think that the definition of what you've taken from the convention and it applies basically the three types of the official curriculum and international curriculum, but they're just working with it from it. So, for example, the act, although it looks like
which is precisely the point I was going to raise when it was made so much. Are we saying that it's okay for an ordinary individual to torture? We refer to it as a public official. Whatever leader is not a public official, in the case of a situation, then he can then say, well, I'm not a public official, and so I have the right to torture people. That's what he's saying. Surely it can't be right. Am I missing something, Tristan? No? Okay. So I'd like you to respond to that. There's one other matter that I want to raise. Person has committed an offense against a South African citizen or against a person who is ordinarily arrested in the United. So what if this person is not a South African citizen and is not ordinarily arrested? It's true on the other side. Does that mean whilst he's on tour and he's regarded as being ordinarily arrested? Or is it okay then to torture him because he's not a citizen and not ordinarily arrested? The other one was, Jeffrey raised it, names are more significant in the convention. If you know, to provide us with that. And then, just so that you don't choose the finger pointing, the names of all the signatories to the convention who have also incorporated the convention into their domestic. Not the address anything about it. Or Sharia. Those details you can give us later.
I'm trying to do this now, and where I call him, I'll hand it very kindly over to Mr. Dowd.
Let's hear this last question. I'm sorry.
I actually got a question, but it's fine. The position on the Opcat, we're a cemetery, we have a Vatican. The optional protocol to
okay, I'm going to try and do this, and hopefully I can satisfy some of your concerns or address some of your concerns. Okay, first of all, I want to address the thing about Article 3 and the extradition. Now, let me just quickly get that. I had it a couple of minutes ago. We addressed that that was actually one of the problems that we had. Let me just find my notes again.
Sorry, while my colleague is ready, I can mention that we've got a small research paper on that specific article, which I've discussed with Ms. Manuel yesterday, and we decided before we make that available to the committee, we would like to sit down some more and refine it somewhat and do a little bit more of work, but we will make that available in the course of the next few days to the committee. Article 3 about the extradition. Just briefly, I think our position is extradition is sufficiently covered by the laws on extradition as it is at the moment. But we did do some comparative research to determine whether we need in fact to do more than that.
Okay, I'm going to just quickly read out quite research, and we will make that available in writing to the committee. That's okay with you.
I think we've got you. If the objectives of the bill are to give effect to our obligations in terms of the convention, you want to then know how Article 3 is covered by existing law. May be linked to the Constitutional Court decisions rather than existing law, I mean the interpretation of our law. That current Constitutional Court case in terms of what happens when you've got a criminal who you can't extradite and what you do with them, they're meant to be really important. I think it's quite crucial.
On the question of local sanctions, now we did some research on this and we got input from a handbook on state obligations under the UN Convention Against Torture. And on page 29 of that handbook, it says that those practices widely accepted as legitimate by international community, such as the deprivation of liberty to imprisonment, provided it meets basic international standards. That's what's meant by lawful sanctions, not death penalties, or that won't be considered as lawful. That's one of the problems. I think that countries still have the death penalty cases, but according to the handbook, that's what they consider as lawful sanctions.
So, has America not ratified?
She won't.
I think I just want to get my notes on that. I've got a whole list of the countries here. That's okay. Just to answer to Jesse's question of the United States of America, on 18 April 1988 they signed it, and on 21 October 1994 they ratified. Regarding the question of OPCAT, I have made inquiries from our branch, International Relations, and they think we haven't ratified that OPCAT yet. They are in the process, and they hope that later in this year that convention will be ratified, but that yet, not that it isn't ratified, OPCAT yet. You can just get to the other question.
Back to the handbook that I've read from you now, and they have
a whole paragraph on public official on the convention. They say the definition of torture in Article 1 is very closely tied to the idea of torture and inhuman and degrading treatment being a purposive official act. This is a reflection of the problem which the convention is meant to address, namely that of torture in which the authorities of a country are themselves involved and in respect of which the machinery of investigation and prosecution might therefore not function normally. It follows from the text of Article 1 that it does not apply to private acts of cruelty. International concern arises only where cruelty has official sanction, the rationale being that private conduct is normally sanctioned under the national law. The element of official sanction is stated in very broad terms and extends to officials who take a passive attitude or return a blind eye to torture committed against opponents of the government in power, be it by unofficial groups or by the authorities. Failure to act in such cases could well be interpreted at least as acquiescence.
Just on the matter of who was consulted, I see that apart from the usual suspects, as well as the Chief Justice having been consulted, as far as the police go, where our problem would lie, the bill was prepared after consultation with the ministers of police and prisons, but would there not be a case for getting the views of François Beekman, firstly, perhaps from our side, but also police proper, I mean, whether is there no input here from
the National
Commissioner, in whichever incarnation, present, immediate past, or slightly more distant past?
We have requested written comments from the Minister of Police and the Minister of Correctional Services. And Sajisa, under the Minister of Correctional Services, has made an input. We haven't received any input despite various requests for some input. We haven't had any written input from the Minister of Police.
Also down to anybody who's in Africa, but also down to children in school industry, illegal immigrants in detention centers, education detained in institutions. So we've had a lot of problems probably involving CSD with education and health. That's part of it.
Maybe I may interrupt very briefly. Some members may have noticed the desktop on my laptop. Mm-hmm. It is available at a small fee. It's $3 million.
There is
a
very
good
Defense to be consulted also?
They're not at war. to do these things when it's water.
Yes, I think you must always bear in mind that in the process of getting cabinet approval for the introduction of bills, we go through a very rigid process in India. There's a so-called JPCS cluster attended by all the directors general of the various departments, and they are in our cluster. So there's simply no way that we can ever approach all of them with something without having gone through all those channels. In the process, the head of the Defence Force would have definitely noted and been consulted and informed of exactly what is about to happen. And then thereafter there's a cabinet committee, once again within the cluster, and finally cabinet itself. So in those three processes, everybody who's anybody who needs to know anything about this would have been consulted.
Unless you're suggesting that the problem is a deadly force.
No, a follow-up to the answer, just you why mention this then, if they are all in any sense supposed to be consensus?
I think it's just a formal requirement. The rule says we must sign off just when that was handed in.
No, Chairperson, that can't be. Because you know that the number of times when we deal with this bill, there will be people who come to us to say, well, we were supposed to be consensus.
Well, when that happens, then you're asking why they weren't part of the process at this analysis. That's how I understand the process myself.
Remember, they recently passed the traveling bill. Yes. Okay.
Yes. But we have that experience. We can't sit there with them while they go through this process. Anything else? We might put out adverts for you for this edition. Yes. Thank you.